Isaiah 36. I think one of the themes that comes out of the Hezekiah account is of partial commitment to God. And if you have partial commitment, unfortunately, you can just be 50-50 with God. You are going, I'm afraid, to slip down to zero ultimately. Although we fail, and as Paul says in Romans 7, basically, in reality, we're never going to be perfect, and we are going to continue sinning. Unfortunately, that is the reality on the ground. We should not do so, but I'm afraid we will. No one is going to arrive at their grave planks kind of perfect. Because of that, okay, that is how it is. But you can be like that. That is unfortunately how it is. And yet, in your heart, be 100% committed to the ways of God, not 50-50 at all. Like Paul says, with my mind, with my heart, I serve the law of God, but with the flesh, the law of sin. And so I think why Hezekiah went wrong, and why in the end Judah and Israel went so wrong, was because of this idea that we can somehow be part of God's people, we can be part of God's plan, and yet also have a foot in other camps. Just one little example, verse 3. Then Eliakim, son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, and Shebna the scribe, came out to him. So, these three guys, Eliakim, who was over the household, Shebna the scribe, and Joah the recorder, are clearly the effective leadership of Judah. They're the ones who do the negotiation with Rabshakeh. Let's just think about Shebna. Now, this is an Egyptian name. So this guy's from Egypt. And Hezekiah had made a deal with the Egyptians. He had said, well, can you support us against these Assyrians who are attacking us, please? And sure they did, but I think there was a price tag attached to that. And Isaiah is very critical of Hezekiah in the first section of his prophecy. He's very down on Hezekiah, although the historical record is more positive about Hezekiah. I think he did have some peaks of faith and commitment in his earlier life, but particularly as the years went on and the Assyrian invasion came, I really think that Hezekiah is very critical of him. Sorry, that Isaiah is very critical of him on God's behalf. Well, he'd made this deal with Egypt, which God was against, Isaiah was against, because effectively he was saying we'll trust in the chariots of Egypt rather than in God's angelic cherubim. The fact that one angel did go out and save him, I think, was grace indeed, and in response to Isaiah and the faithful remnant rather than Hezekiah's faith. So he makes this deal with Egypt, and I think that part of the deal was that Shebna, an Egyptian, would effectively be a lead ruler in the cabinet, as it were, of Hezekiah. Hezekiah remained king, but de facto Shebna was the leader. And so in Isaiah 22, God says that Shebna is to be thrown out and replaced by Eliakim. Shebna's attitude, we're told in Isaiah 22, was, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we will die. And straight after you read that, you read that God says to Isaiah, go to Shebna, who is over the house, and say, what are you doing here? Whom do you have here that you have dug out a tomb here, cutting himself out a tomb on high? Why was God so mad with Shebna for making himself an elaborate grave or tomb? It's because, what are you doing here? It's because he was considering himself to be one of the kings of Judah. And that's why God was mad that he was making this tomb for himself amongst the tombs of the kings of Judah. His attitude was, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we will die. And he's like, yeah, when I die, I'm going to have such a great funeral, you know, 21-gun salute, and I shall be, well, I mean, you know what I'm saying, and I shall be buried in a fancy-pansy tomb amongst the kings of Judah, because that's who I am, effectively a king of Judah. And so God says about this Shebna, this Egyptian, I will thrust you out from your office. You'll be pulled down from your station. And I will call my servant Eliakim, and I will clothe him with your robe, strengthen him with your belt, and I will commit your government into his hand. And he, not you, will be a father or a leader to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and the house of Judah. And I will lay the key of the house of David on his shoulder, not on yours. In other words, this Shebna was effectively the governor, although Hezekiah was theoretically in name the king. Shebna the Egyptian was effectively the governor. And God says, no, I'm going to take that government away from you and give it to Eliakim. Well, what happened in Isaiah 36? Well, here you see Eliakim is over the house, but Shebna is the scribe. Well, what they'd done was to try to placate Isaiah, get around God's requirement. They had not cast out Shebna. What they'd done was, as corporations often do when somebody gets caught with their pants down, okay, well, yes, we'll remove him from that position, but just give him an equivalent one in another branch of the corporation. And that's what they did with Shebna, what Hezekiah did. Sure, Shebna was not to be over the household. Okay, so Eliakim was, just as God had said. But Shebna is not thrown out of the country. They do not break the deal with the Egyptians. They simply make Shebna the scribe, and he's still in a leadership position because there he is dealing with Rabshakeh and co. He's clearly one of the three leaders of Hezekiah's kind of politburo. So, the lesson, of course, for us is don't try and get around God's law. Don't look for loopholes. Because if you love God, that's not the way you are. To love God means to really want to go his way. Not to treat his law as if it's a leash or a chain and you're trying to wriggle around it. This is the way of the flesh. This is not the way of love at all. Now, this problem of dual, having a foot in both camps, sort of dual attitudes, you see it all the way through, I'm afraid, with Judah. And you see a horrible thing in verse 7, where Rabshakeh says, if you tell me we trust in Yahweh, isn't it Yahweh whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah has taken away? Well, the high places and altars that Hezekiah took away were to the idols. And yet, Rabshakeh, who I think was an apostate Jew, he speaks in Hebrew fluently and knows exactly what's going on, quotes the prophecies of Micah about every man living under their own vine and fig tree. He says, well, yeah, these high places and altars that Hezekiah smashed up, when he smashed up idolatry, they were used for Yahweh worship, were they not? And of course, he was right, they were. So all their idolatry that they did was actually done and justified as a form of Yahweh worship. So you see, this again is the problem of having a foot in both camps. Israel never said, Yahweh, we want nothing to do with you. We abrogate you. We are nothing to do with you. We are now worshipping whatever it was, Moloch, Baal, or Astarte, or whatever it was. No, they never said that. Effectively, they did, but they never said that. They were weeping over the temple, oh, how we love the temple, how we love you, God, Yahweh, etc. They were doing all the idolatry in the name of Yahweh worship. And this is where it bites so relevantly and so close to home. Because so often we justify our idolatry, our weakness, our selfishness, our self-indulgence, in the name of serving God. You take gossip. That's a common tendency of the flesh. Oh, but I did it because of my overpowering love for my dear brother. I had to just warn him that actually, Sister So-and-so, apparently is this, that, and the other. And apparently, many years ago, Sister So-and-so did this. And apparently, yes, it's felt by some that Sister So-and-so is this, that, or the other. Oh, because of my overpowering love, I have to inform you of that. No, forget overpowering love. You are a gossip. That is what you are. And so it's done in the heat of the moment, in the name of love, in the name of my devotion to truth and all this kind of thing. all sorts of things. You know, young guy likes travelling, or I'm going to go and do missionary work in some far-off place where all the other young guys who are secular people are going because it's fun to go there. Oh, yeah, I'm going to go there as well. But because I'm a preacher, you see, no, this is all justifying what we want to do with this veneer of, oh, but it's for God. Want a new kitchen. I'm not talking about myself, but, you know, I want a new kitchen. Oh, because I need to entertain people from the church and people less fortunate than ourselves. So I need this fancy-pantsy kitchen because of my great devotion to, you know, people. I'm not saying you don't need a new kitchen or that you don't need a kitchen. Of course, you do. That's part of life. But, you know, what I'm talking about, some totally fancy-pantsy, expensive, hugely expensive kitchen because of my great love for the homeless and my great desire to feed God's people and so on and so forth. See, this is the way we think, and it's having a foot in both camps. Now, sure, I accept that we will never in that sense totally stop sinning. We will never have totally pure motives. This is what I think Romans 7 is saying. But what I think you can have is a heart position where, for all my failure, I absolutely am committed to God's way. And no, I don't want a foot in both camps. And no, I despise all attempts to find legal loopholes around God's requirements and all that. No, not at all. We're saved not by works, not by good deeds or anything like that, but by faith in God's grace. But if you have believed that if I die at this moment or Jesus comes back right now, I will be saved, wow, that is so wonderful that I want to respond. And how do you respond? I can't be passive to that. Well, that's where commandment and will of God, the desires of God come in. This is a path through which you show your gratitude for his salvation. Now, if that's the path he's shown you, you're not going to be kind of casuistically trying to sort of get around this, that, or the other and finding loopholes. No, with your whole heart and soul, you want to do his will, quite simply, because you love him.